We turn now to the last section of the Rule of Saint Benedict, and having studied these texts for many centuries, monastic scholars have come to the conclusion that the latter portion of the rule was probably written later. That is to say, Benedict wrote a text which included most of what he regarded as significant, and then modified a few things at the end, including a chapter 72 on the section on a mutual love of the brethren, or what he calls the good zeal, and also a question on mutual obedience. And it seems likely that the chapter which we'll be looking at on the abbot also received some augmentation based on principles that arose over the course of years in Benedict's own monastery and which caused him to recraft and reshape the document which he had originally created. Here again, we'll see specific admonitions and hints as to how the process of spiritual guidance or spiritual formation is to be undertaken, the responsibilities that are expected of the one doing the formation, and the docility and openness to God expected of the one who is receiving spiritual guidance. And we begin in chapter 58 with the practice or the discipline of receiving new brothers. There is an ancient monastic tradition of testing those who come by having them repeat over and over the fact that they want to join the monastery. The old Desert Father tradition specifically mentions people who would be left outside the door and not admitted initially until they made it very clear and in a sense were heroically committed to the prospect of staying. Benedict is nowhere near as strict as that. He speaks of a patient endurance of injuries that are done and difficulties concerning entrance for 4 or 5 days. This does not mean that one engaged in artificial humiliations or anything of that sort, although in the 17th century there were branches of monastic orders which believed that that would be helpful. I don't think anyone does that anymore. But in Benedict himself, it seems more likely that the practice of really experiencing community, of simply being together with others, itself entails all the presumed and sometimes imagined injury that comes whenever one is starting something new or trying to work with any new community. There's often a lot of uneasiness, a sense of inadequacy, a fear of and a sense of having offended and of having received offense. The endurance of this is an important component to a willingness to be formed, he says. And then he speaks of the one who is specifically responsible for offering spiritual guidance in the monastery in verse 6. A senior, which is an older monk, who is skilled, he says, at winning souls. Ad lucrandas animas aptus. Someone who is gifted for the cultivation of winning, in a sense, that is to say, winning the salvation of the other. Someone who is capable of genuinely working at discovering what the other needs and how they can grow spiritually, and he says this individual will watch over him with all care. So there is a care and compassion for those who are being formed that is expected of those who are going to provide them with spiritual guidance. And the things they look for in verse 7 are whether they seek God. Number one, does the person genuinely seek God? Deum querit. Is it God for whom one is here, or is it some other purpose? Romanticism. And one could ask this about all kinds of relationships. What is it one is seeking in the relationship? Ultimately, for the Christian, the relationship needs to be sought for God's sake. One needs to find God and seek God in the other. And in the context of community, that's what one's there for, seeking God. Then, eagerness, he says, whether there is an eagerness for, number one, the work of God, that is the Liturgy of the Hours, the primary work of the monk or the nun, the engaging in the practice of reciting the psalmody, proclaiming and listening to the readings, engaging in the prayer of the community. Benedict, in light and with the whole of the ancient tradition, calls this the work of God. Also for obedience, for accepting rank in community, and the necessity to see another as one whom one perceives as speaking with or with the voice of God, or at least providing what is necessary within the community for mutual growth and moving forward. And he says for humbling experiences, for opprobria. Again, not necessarily induced, they will be there, simply as a part of living in community. And to this individual should be proclaimed everything of the dura et aspera, the roughness and the pain, the hardship and the difficulty by which we journey towards God. He does not, again, mean that this is going to be a particularly ascetical for its own sake kind of experience, or that the individual is going to have to undertake obscure asceticisms that only serve the purpose of causing physical or spiritual pain. On the contrary, the life itself will provide more than adequate experience of opprobria. The question is the individual going to be able to deal with this? And the task of the formator, and this is vital, is to be honest about that, to communicate clearly what it is will happen in the context of the life. So there is an openness to the other, an awareness of what that person needs, and a willingness on the part of those who offer spiritual guidance in this context to be honest about what the spiritual journey will entail. A frankness and an openness that is not merely a kind of a reinforcing of a romantic ideal, despite whether it's lived out in the community, but a willingness to look specifically at the difficulties themselves. These are the people. This is the lifestyle. These are the expectations in prayer. That's going to constitute part of the opprobria, the difficulties of one's perseverance. And I think this is a very beautiful and very helpful principle that can be generalized to many aspects of spiritual guidance and spiritual formation. An openness and an honesty to the project as nearly as one can see it and experience it, and then to help the other cope with the reality. Again, St. Thomas Aquinas emphasizes so strongly in several points in the Summa that humility is truth, that ultimately one has to be able to honestly see what is true about the self and about God, and that will be sufficiently humbling in itself. To communicate that, to have this spirit of openness and honesty, and again, not just a kind of a, let's see if we can get your rose-colored glasses more rose-tinted, if we can encourage a fantasy about what you imagine religious life or married life or any other context might be, not the revival of or encouragement of fantasies, but the actual experience of God in the reality as it is lived. That's the task of those who are involved in spiritual guidance and formation, according to Saint Benedict. And then, having seen it, having heard the rule read out three times, or reading it three times, especially during the year of novitiate, the person is invited, either, as he puts it in verses 9 and 10, to enter, if you wish, or to freely depart. It is the cultivation of the freedom in the other to stay in a particular path or to leave. Of course, not to leave relationship with God, but part of discernment, real discernment of one's task or one's path lies in discovering that freedom which enables one to say, I choose to stay or I choose to go in regard to this particular kind of decision. And that, of course, is still what discernment most specifically means. Freedom is required among Christians. Sacraments are ineffective without the requisite freedom. So, moving on, at least in particular the sacraments of matrimony and of holy orders, one has to be free and one has to make that fundamental choice, and that reality, if you will, that sacramental insight is a kind of an external, vivid reminder of an interior spiritual reality, which St. Benedict is highlighting here. All important life choices need to be embraced in a spirit of freedom after honesty and openness in regard to what the choice entails. We'll then drop down to chapter 60, and here, the chapter on priests who wish to live in the monastery, we'll just note in passing that Benedict makes a big change in monastic life in the sense that his primary source, the rule of the master, does not want priests in the monastery. For him, the monastery is an exclusively lay phenomenon. It is not clerical. He has no interest in encouraging priests or even permitting priests who join, if they do, to exercise their ministries. Benedict's big change is that priests may join the monastery and the abbot may ask monks to be ordained. That's a fundamental change and a shift in a direction that would result in what one might regard as an overly clericalized monasticism of the High Middle Ages and extending into modern times, but nonetheless a respect for the sacrament of orders in the context of monastic life, which was not widespread and certainly was not present in Benedict's primary source. And in regard to clerics, he respects their order, he allows them to exercise their ministry, but they retain the statio, that is to say, they retain the place in their community rank, which is according to the date of their entrance, not according to their status as cleric. So there is both a respect for the clerical order and an incorporation of it in a unique way into the context of monastic life. In chapter 61, those who visit become a part of a process of discernment for the community. You find out whether the individual is content with what they find, but you may also, in verse 4 of chapter 61, the individual who comes and stays in community may reasonably and with humble charity criticize or suggest something, and the abbot should prudently consider whether the Lord may have sent this individual for that very reason. And notice this text is in black. That's Benedict's own insight. We must be open, those in authority, those giving advice must be open to the possibility that someone who is new to the process or the practice may well have insights that we can learn from. And we need to have a willingness to listen and to be open to that and prudently consider, as Benedict says, whether the Lord may have sent them to us for precisely that purpose. If we then move down a couple of chapters, past chapters 62 and 63, the central point I'd like us to look at again has to do with the abbot. And remember again, the chapters on the abbot are not just about the one individual who is responsible for the whole community. It also refers to what we might call, and again this is clear in Benedict's primary source, the rule of the master, the abbatial function in everyone. Each one of us, insofar as there are areas over which we exercise responsibility, often delegated responsibility, we too must exercise the same craft, the same skill, the same delicacy of handling which Benedict expects of the abbot. So this is a chapter which is intended for the spiritual formation both of formators, of those who are also in charge and offer advice, but it's also something that is provided for all of those who are involved in the process of life in community as well. He begins in verses 1 to 6 in talking about the appointment of the abbot. How is the abbot selected? Well, selected by the community for the individual's merit of their life. But if the community, he says, appoints someone who is notoriously unworthy, then Benedict believes that even the autonomy of the local community can and should be overridden by the local bishop for the sake of the good. That there are circumstances in which the proper autonomy of a community may be set aside in favor of a greater good if the community is behaving in an inappropriate, and here he puts specifically a neglectful or sinful way, which is very remarkable because Benedict is very strong on the autonomy of the local community, but it is not an autonomy that separates it from the jurisdiction of the local ordinary, the jurisdiction of the bishop. Even in Benedict's day, even in this developing sense of the uniqueness of the monastic community, Benedict is vitally concerned that it be integrated into the local church in a way that partakes of and is even willing to submit to the spiritual advice and correction and even juridical reform that might be imposed from someone outside the community. In verse 7, he describes the necessity of pondering on the burden that one has received, which we already saw in the earlier chapter on the abbot, and that a reminder that he will have to give account of his stewardship to God. Therefore, he says, this person, and again, there's a portion of all of us which have to be this, he should be learned in divine law, knowing how to bring forth new things and old, drawing from the ancient tradition and from contemporary usages, exercising chastity, sobriety, practicing mercy, and he says, always allowing mercy to triumph above judgment so that he may also receive mercy. So Benedict needs and emphasizes the importance of a focus on mercy in working in authority, in dispensing or offering spiritual guidance to others. Probably this is something he's felt the need to reassert toward the end of his life and restate at the end of his rule, because there can, of course, be in those who offer to others a kind of a sense of being lawgiver or truth teller. There can be a sense in which mercy kind of fades to one side. For Benedict, it's absolutely essential. And how you do this, so the focus is, he says in verse 11, you must hate vices, but love the brethren. Diligat fratres, oderit vitia. You are to love the brethren and hate the vices. And in correction, acting prudently and avoiding extremes. So this is a classic phrase that's often quoted, so that in trying too ardently to scrape off the rust, he must avoid breaking the vessel. In order to effect change, you must not destroy the individual. And the best way of doing this, he says in verse 13, is always be aware of your own frailty, remembering Christ and who did not even break the bruised reed, in fulfilling this prophecy of Isaiah. This doesn't mean that you allow vices to sprout. He says instead you prudently and charitably cut them off, but you should strive, he says, to be loved rather than feared. Studiat plus amari quam timeri. And he'll have another little phrase rather like this. He says this person involved in spiritual guidance, in leadership, should not be turbulent or anxious, not excessive or obstinate or jealous. He is to be discerning and moderate. And he says discretio is the mother of all virtues. Balance, and also the constant desire, the focus on finding and seeing through discernment the will of God. He says that he must regulate everything. And again, this is so important for all of those involved in offering spiritual advice, so that the strong may have something to yearn for and the weak are not frightened away. So that you can always provide a difficult goal for those who are capable of achieving it, but not frighten away those who are just beginning or are less capable, to adapt the recommendation and the goal that one provides to the capacity of each. And so we then can move past the section on the prior of the monastery, chapter 65. Benedict is rather suspicious of the second superior and is concerned that this office may result in occasions of pride in the monastery. The porters, chapter 66, are those who welcome others, and Benedict's aware that this will often be someone who may not be the most gifted or capable person, but he says that they need to be provided with what they need so that they can give a blessing and receive a blessing from those who arrive and have what they need so they don't have to wander off in their work. Then if we drop down several chapters, to chapter 71, obedience is to be offered, he says, not just to the superior, but to all. We are to have this openness, this willingness to engage in an obsculta, as he puts it at the very beginning of the rule, a listening to the other, and that word audire is also contained in the word for obedience. Obedience entails a profound listening to the one who speaks, and it's to be offered not just to the one in charge, but in this, as we've seen, discerning in a communal kind of context way to all of those with whom one lives. And physically speaking, that means even offering a prostration to the other, which literally means offering one's honest admission of the fact that Christ is present in the other, and that one can do homage before another because they bear Christ. And that's even more clearly seen in this beautiful chapter 72 on the good zeal. Benedict spends very little time talking about what he calls the evil zeal of bitterness, the zelus amaritudinis malus, which is described in many other authors and even by Benedict himself as murmur ratio, in the New Testament gongizmos, which is the murmuring of those who hate the Lord and which eventually transforms into their active persecution and destruction of Christ's life. This murmur ratio, which in the context of community, especially when it's manifested in backbiting and in jealousy and in slander and gossip is really destructive. Benedict describes it as an evil zeal of bitterness which separates from vices, which separates from God and leads to hell. But he says there is the opposite. There is a good zeal that separates from vice, leads to God, and leads to everlasting life. This zeal, he says, should be practiced by monks with the most fervent love, ferventissimo amore, that they should outdo one another in showing honor. And this, for him, is probably the high point of monastic life. For interpersonal experience of relationship, and we'll highlight this again in our section on friendship, the only competition, the only praeveniat that one engages in the monastery is to outdo one another in showing honor. Literally to say, I'm better than you are at seeing Christ in you. I can perceive the Lord in you in a way you can't. And that is the basis for the necessity of spiritual guidance. The other can see Christ in me better than I can. And I need to hear what of Christ they see. I need to be reminded of that good news of Christ's indwelling in me, which only happens when I'm willing to see it in the eyes, hear it in the voice of another. And in practical terms, this is lived out in verses 5 through 11 of chapter 72, by patiently enduring one another's infirmities, practicing fraternal charity, offering God-loving reverence, loving their abbot with honesty, sincere and humble affection, and then preferring nothing whatever to Christ in this beautiful conclusion, ad vitam aeternam pariter perducat. Christ is bringing us together, pariter, into eternal life. We do not go alone to God. We lift one another up in offering spiritual counsel and receiving spiritual guidance from one another, rather like the early Christian notion of a prayer for one another that we saw effectively activated in the life of Saints Perpetua and Felicity. We go together to God unto everlasting life.